A Russian pessimist will denounce a policeman for killing a peasant, then prove by the highest philosophical principles that the peasant ought to have killed himself.
That was a quote from a famous philosopher talking about the absurdity of a culture without truth. In the absence of a God, can there be any foundation for truth? Or is everything without meaning? Find out today on Just Thinking with author and apologist Ravi Zacharias. If you've been listening in this week, you know that we're now to part three of Ravi Zacharias' series, Why I Am Not an Atheist. Ravi pointed out yesterday that denying God's existence leads to a contradictory life. He continues along those lines in today's episode and shows how divided and fragmented life becomes in the absence of God. If law, ethics, and man himself aren't based on an absolute God, what happens? Let's join Ravi now as he takes a look at the result. A 21st century schizoid man.
The first struggle that the atheist has is the espousing of a moral law. The second is the problem with no hope. Atheism, basically as a personal philosophy of life, offers no ultimate hope. Death is the end of personal existence as we know it. It is a snuffing out of the center of consciousness within the individual. I think, was it Hobbes who said, when I die, the worms will devour my body and I commit my soul to the great perhaps. Bertrand Russell himself talked about it as a random collocation of atoms, mindless, without ultimate destiny. And ultimately, in the collapse of the universe, will bring all of our hopes crashing in disaster and pessimism. So said Bertrand Russell. Now, you know, when death knocks at the door, it is funny how few people I know of who turn to the great philosophers for answers. I have buried a father and a mother, and my mother died fairly early. And I still recall standing by her bedside, seeing her in her last few moments of life. I didn't think of going to some great masterpiece of classical philosophy at that point. The big question I struggled with, and here it is, ladies and gentlemen. You see, life has a singular strength in each individual. Life does not come to you and me in a generic sense. Life comes in a singular sense. That's why we fall in love with a single individual. That's why you get the whole idea of loving your children in a way you probably love them in that singular commitment to that child or to the partner with whom you're wedded, or the romance where there's that singularity of love. It is just not replaced by another person taking on the generic nature of love itself. And when the person dies, the question has to be raised, is this the terminal point of my relationship with that individual? You see, it's also raised in terms of philosophy. If death is the end of everything that we know, what does that make of justice, which is not carried out in our courts of law? What does that make of any ultimate sense of right and wrong? What about this whole issue of what happens to a human being when he or she dies? The issue of a moral law, the issue of a loss of hope. Thirdly, without God, there is a complete loss of meaning. There is no point of reference that defines what the meaning of life is all about. Whether you see the parable of the myth of Sisyphus, rolling up the stones as it were up the mountain only to roll it down again, and that repetitive meaningless event goes on and on and on. And there's a fascinating philosophical response to how they deal with this. Do you know, in the scientific world, when they deal with the second law of thermodynamics, that things left to themselves move to entropy, to heat death, you see the whole idea that things don't move from disorder to order. They move from order to disorder. And when you see how biological evolution is defended, they defend it by saying that the biological parts moved against the entropic stream. That what applied to the whole did not apply to the parts. That's what they tell you. Now in meaning, they reverse the whole thing. In meaning, they tell you life ultimately has no meaning. It doesn't apply to the whole, but it does apply to the parts. Give your day-to-day activity tiny little meanings so that there are punctuated meanings under an arching overall meaninglessness. And so tiny little purposes with no ultimate purpose, tiny little meanings with no ultimate meanings. This is why the King Crimson Rock Group says this: cat's foot, iron claw, neurosurgeons scream for more from paranoia's poison door, 21st century schizoid man. Blood rack, barbed wire, politicians, funeral pyre, innocents raped with napalm fire, 21st century schizoid man. Death seed, blind man's greed, poets starving, children bleed, nothing he's got he really needs, 21st century schizoid man. Now listen to the connection, despite what David Hume would say. The walls on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. Will no one lay the laurel wreath as silence drowns the screams? Between the iron gates of fate, the seeds of time are sown and watered by the deeds of those who know and who are known. Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind, I see, is in the hands of fools. Confusion will be my epitaph as I crawl a cracked and broken path. If we make it, we can all sit back and laugh, but I'm afraid tomorrow I'll be crying. There's the second level philosophy for you. The moral philosophers of our time who are demonstrating the anguish. Listen to what one philosopher said of this conflict in which we live now, and that is the philosopher G.K. Chesterton. He wrote on this issue a long time ago, describing modern man in revolt and the schizoid nature in which he lives. Listen to what he says. The modern rebel is a skeptic and will not entirely trust anything. He has no loyalty, therefore he can never be a true revolutionist. And the fact that he doubts everything gets in his way when he wants to denounce anything. For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind. And the modern revolutionist doubts not only the institution he denounces, but the doctrine by which he denounces it. So he writes one book complaining that imperial oppression insults the purity of women. Then he writes another book, a novel, in which he insults it himself. He curses the Sultan because Christian girls lose their virginity, then curses Mrs. Grundy because they keep it. As a politician, he cries out that war is a waste of life, then as a philosopher that all life itself is a waste of time. A Russian pessimist will denounce a policeman for killing a peasant, then prove by the highest philosophical principles that the peasant ought to have killed himself. A man denounces marriage as a lie, then denounces aristocratic profligates for treating it as a lie. He calls a flag a bubble, then blames the oppressors of Poland or Ireland because they take away that bubble. The man of this school goes first to a political meeting where he complains that savages are treated as if they were beasts. Then he takes his hat and umbrella and goes on to a scientific meeting where he proves that they practically are beasts. In short, the modern revolutionist, being an infinite skeptic, is always engaged in undermining his own minds. In his book on politics, he attacks men for trampling on morality. In his book on ethics, he attacks morality for trampling on men. Therefore, the modern man in revolt has become practically useless for all purposes of revolt. By rebelling against everything, he has lost his right to rebel against anything. See the level one and the level two. The philosopher talking about the doctrine of contradiction that overrides this, and the songwriter saying, 21st century schizoid man. How do we find meaning? Can I give you two personal illustrations, if you'll allow me to, and then move to my final thought here? My oldest daughter just went through a horrendous experience in her young 16th year of life. And the last month has been one of me as a father trying to help her cope with this and watch her struggle and bear under the load of this painful experience she's just gone through. She had a friend of hers in class. He was a computer partner for her and very kind, very friendly, very nice to her. Every time she'd come back and say, this fellow's such a fine fellow, Daddy, always so friendly, always being kind to any new student who comes in and so on. Well, within the last month, something tragic happened. That young boy, 16 years old, didn't show up in school one day. And the police came to the school, said they were looking for him because he'd run away from home, and everybody was shocked at this story. Finally, they said they would try to track him down. The principal started working on it and so on. Next day, three students in his class got a telephone call from him saying, I want to see you in a private setting. Don't you dare tell anybody you're coming. So one teacher and I think about two or three students went to see him, supposedly without telling anyone. They were in a secluded setting. Hollywooded area, and they were waiting for him. All of a sudden comes a sleek Volvo with tinted glass windows and so on. As they walked towards him, he rolled down a window. They saw two handguns on his lap, a rifle by his side. They all immediately got nervous, not knowing what they were dealing with. Suddenly, they saw a chopper above them and about 14 police cars and a SWAT team closing in on him. It ensued in a chase, several accidents, finally trapped the 16-year-old fellow. He was at the hub of a major crack ring in Atlanta. 16 years old. They got him. Put him into a detention center. That was Thursday. Sunday morning, the principal went to visit him to find out he'd hanged himself. My daughter has sobbed for hours over this. And she says, I don't understand how somebody so young could have gone so wrong so soon in his life. And I won't give you the details of what brought it about, but the wrongheadedness and the confusion and the emptiness in the teenage world is at an all-time high. You can be sure secularism has not given them any answers. It is at an all-time high. In fact, the recent study of the educational process has revealed that two-thirds of our teenagers are basically unteachable, not because they don't have their minds intact, but their minds are just so preoccupied with the fears and worries with which they live. How is contemporary man going to respond to this? How is he going to respond to the emptiness and loss of meaning?
A newspaper columnist once said, "What can you say about a society that says God is dead and Elvis is alive?" Though that's pretty silly, it does highlight the meaninglessness of life without the truth, as we heard from Robbie Zacharias in today's program. You've been listening to part 3 of Robbie's series entitled, "Why I Am Not an Atheist." This message is available in its complete unedited form, and you can order a copy by calling us at 1-800-448-6766. Again, that number is 1-800-448-6766. If you'd like to place your order online, you can do so at rzim.org. In addition to the items available from our online store, you'll find plenty of other helpful resources at no charge. Check it out next time you're online. That address again is rzim.org. Just Thinking is a listener-supported radio presentation of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Our mailing address is RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia 30010. Finally, what's the last and most ominous outworking of an atheistic view of existence? Find out tomorrow as Ravi Zacharias concludes his thought-provoking series, Why I Am Not an Atheist. Until then, keep thinking.